Welcome to the Bulworth Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. By the way, let me start off with an apology to readers of our newsletter. Did not have a Morning Shots newsletter because a second horse of the apocalypse came along this morning, woke up, no power whatsoever. And in my neck of the woods, that means no internet, no water, no hot water, nothing, no lights. All I had was my phone and Twitter, which really struck me as the perfect simulation of what hell would be like. So our guest today is Ben White, Politico Pro's chief economic correspondent, author of the Morning Money column covering finance and public policy, and he just celebrated a birthday. So happy birthday, Ben.
Thank you so much, Charlie, and I'm really sorry for your technological problems. That does sound like a perfect encapsulation of hell.
It does. Well, it felt like it. So did I notice on Twitter that you have not been shaving?
Have you, I shave before I do TV hits generally, but between TV hits, no, I do not.
So I mentioned this on the podcast the other day that I tried actually doing that same thing. I was waiting to go on television. It was a really long time. But I woke up at 2 a.m. and just couldn't take it anymore. Also, you know, the whole thing was you're growing the beard. You are touching your face a lot. You know,
it's there's that. That's a if I'm going to go outside for any extended period of time, I'll shave, you know, before or after that. But it's a good point that beards do lead to chin scratching.
Okay, so can I read one of your tweets, one of your recent tweets for our audience, just to give people some idea of what life is like for Ben White during the era of pandemic? You had an update. 3 a.m. I mean, this is verbatim. This is verbatim from Ben White's tweet. 3 a.m., panic wake up, Asian markets, Dow futures, fuzzy 4 to 6 sleep, reporting writing, Twitter hell, COVID update, Cuomo, donuts for lunch, existential angst, shower, harassed by dog, markets, Trump presser, reporting writing, Twitter hell, dinnerish writing. So good times, Ben.
Good times. Yeah, that is a typical day in the life of Ben White at this point. Probably a lot of journalists, particularly those of us who cover the economy and markets, and, you know, always wonder if the last thing we wrote the night before is going to be totally blown up by an overnight market crash or something. But yeah, it's not been the greatest. I'm trying to build in a little bit more downtime, a little bit more, you know, reading and quiet time, but it's hard to do when, you know, obviously the world is kind of coming apart at the seams, and then particularly the economy is coming apart at the seams.
Yeah,
and
It is going to hell. Well, I noticed you tweeted out some estimate of the dramatic increase of Netflix watching, you know, what people are doing during all of this. And you said, well, some of us are like working.
It's I wish I could binge Netflix all day. Believe me, I would do it in a second, you know, and I do a little bit at night, you know, when I can't sleep, I'll watch some stuff. But during the day, I'm just pretty much jamming.
You know, I think that some of us, I actually do have that fear that I'm missing out on something. I haven't watched anything about the Tigers or anything, but it's kind of hard to get into that mode. Okay, so this is a particularly grim day. I feel like I've said this before, but the president came out, gave that press conference where they estimated that somewhere between 100,000 and 240,000 Americans may die. Even with all the mitigation things that we're doing here. And he had a little chart showing this was the goal, that the goal was 100 to 240,000. And there was the implication that if only 100,000 Americans died, that Donald Trump would spike the football and that would be considered a kind of a win.
Yeah, that was pretty shocking to me. I mean, I shouldn't say shocking, not terribly surprising. He's always been a master of not moving the goalposts, but just changing the entire field. I mean, he obviously said early on that this was totally under control and that we could limit it to, you know, 15 dead or whatever the early number was, and you know, be no problem. And then we'd be open by Easter. And now he's set up this, you know, 100 to 240,000 as a victory over, you know, the grimmer forecasts of 1 million to 2 million plus. You know, it's pretty amazing that he could move the goalpost that way. And I mean, those are crazy numbers. You know, 100 to 200,000 is a mass death toll, you know, akin to World War I. And it's depressing and shocking, yeah, and politically kind of crazy that, yeah, now that's his measure of victory.
So Michael Barbaro from the New York Times tweeted out, under the best case scenario, Trump will see more Americans die from the coronavirus in the weeks to come than Presidents Harry Truman, Dwight Eisenhower, John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and Richard M. Nixon saw die in the Korean and Vietnam Wars combined. Wow. So the big one of the questions, and I want to get to the economy in a moment, I mean, you know, how this plays politically, and there was maybe one indicator out there. Mike Francesca, big sports radio guy out in your neck of the woods, big Trump supporter, right? I mean, he's been all in Trump world, right? Mike Francesca up until
Francesca, yeah, definitely has.
Francesca, I'm sorry. See, this shows that I'm from Wisconsin as opposed.
Yeah,
to
yeah, no yeah. worries. Francesca's been on my radio for 20 years, and for a long time I couldn't stand him. Although my kid likes him, so we listen to him. But I've been really interested in his commentaries lately.
Well, this is what he had to say yesterday.
And how can you have a scoreboard that says 2,000 people have died and tell us it's okay if another 198,000 die? That's a good job. How is that a good job in our country? It's a good job if nobody else dies. Not if another 198,000 people die. So now 200,000 people are disposable?
Yeah, so this is not playing well. This apparently has not reassured folks. We don't know what the poll numbers are going to be, but we're waking up, and it didn't seem like the market was particularly reassured by this.
No, certainly not. And it's 100 to 200,000 people dying. You know, obviously that's the human cost is what we should be focused on. But the political implications of that, I think, are big. I've been surprised that there's at least some in the Trump MAGA world that are still rallying to him even after he's said this. You know, I compared the 100,000 number to the 115,000 soldiers who died for the U.S. in World War One, and I got pretty roundly attacked from Trump supporters who say it's not a fair comparison because this is, the virus that he can't control and that he's done everything from the start. So, that 30% whatever hardcore base isn't going anywhere, unless it really gets out of control. No. But I do think it's a big, big problem for him in a lot of states where, he's wavering, and if this thing goes as south as it looks like it's going, I don't know how you kind of battle back from that.
I got a similar reaction when I tweeted out a story that we had done pointing out that the number of deaths from the coronavirus was now greater than the number of casualties from 9/11. People are saying, how can you compare the two? These, of course, were people who had spent the last month tweeting out comparisons to the common cold or the common flu,
right.
And all of this. And I think, Stuart Stevens is a good friend of ours, and he had a tweet. He said, a bizarre aspect of a Trump loyalist is their ability to exist in a world made fresh every day with no collective memory. It's a goldfish.
Yeah,
it's a goldfish-like quality. If today Trump says the sky is blue, that he spent months calling it green, that this no longer exists. And of course, Rich Lowry, the editor of National Review, kind of stumbled into this because he tweeted out how great it was that the president was pushing back against the notion this was just the flu, and people were going, wait.
Yeah.
It was Trump himself who had said this was just the flu.
Right. Or that how many people do we lose each year by flu, like when he was trying to downplay it. I mean, it's incredible to me that Rich would say that. I mean, he's a smart guy.
But we've always been at war with East Asia. Right. Always been. But there is that memory hole, and we've lived through this where something will happen. And a week later, I'll say, hey, do you remember this? And people go, oh, yeah, that's right. And part of the problem is it takes longer to go through all of the times that Trump has misled or diminished or downplayed all of this. I mean, it takes, maybe 4.5 minutes to do that. Whereas, in MAGA world, just to say he was on it from the beginning. And in fact, and they rolled out this new thing yesterday that it's the Democrats because of impeachment, that he was distracted by it.
Man, it drives me nuts. I can't stand it. It's so unbelievably ridiculous and nonsensical a defense. I mean, they have to come up with something, that it's the Democrats' fault or liberals' fault or whatever. And whatever you think about impeachment, media, whether it was legit or not, the idea that that somehow stopped the administration from taking the coronavirus seriously is just beyond absurd. I mean, of course, they could have been doing that at the same time.
But you knew that it was kind of a coordinated, was part of that that MAGA nexus of McConnell and Hugh Hewitt and others pushing out that line.
Yeah.
And then I thought it was kind of interesting when the president was asked about it at the press briefing yesterday.
Yeah.
And essentially said, no, I don't think I would have done a better job if I hadn't been impeached. So he kind of dropped a truth bomb, yeah, which will last again for give it a few minutes.
Right.
Before they go back to making this argument. And this is, again, I feel like we've done this before. All of the pundits, all of the folks in the media who, you know, after yesterday's briefing, were going, well, now he gets it. OK, well, now this is the new Donald Trump, the new serious Donald Trump. It's like, folks, have you been paying attention? At all.
I've seen this movie about 1,000 times, and it wouldn't surprise me one bit if we saw an all caps tweet later in the day that says, at some point in the coming days, that says, you know, Democrats' fault because they impeached me and took all the attention away from, you know, how it would have fixed the coronavirus, like, and just pretend he never said what he said at the press conference, and everybody in MAGA world will accept that, and that will be the line.
They will accept that, and you can already see that we are living through this extraordinary rewriting of history, and it's going to be interesting to see how it plays and how it works. The attempt to say just, you know, shape reality that no, there was never a delay. No, we never suggested it was just the flu. We never abolished that pandemic office in the NSC. We didn't cut the budget for the equipment, the infrastructure. It's really all Andrew Cuomo's fault. We'll see whether or not that works. The contrast between, and I'm not an Andrew Cuomo fan, but the contrast between the Andrew Cuomo briefings and the Trump briefings are pretty dramatic.
They are pretty dramatic. You know, my mom is a big Cuomo briefing fan, so she always starts texting me during the briefings, and so I make sure I don't miss them. Not that I do; I have the TV on, of course. But yeah, his command of facts, his kind of breadth of understanding of how the situation is playing out in New York City and New York State, and the idea of, you know, how you need to prepare by stockpiling enough ventilators for the apex and then move them around the country as needed, and his kind of rebuffs of these ideas coming out of Trump and the White House that New York is somehow scamming and stealing stuff, whereas the reality is, you know, we're on a curve, we hit an apex. When you hit the apex, you need all that PPE and ventilators. And then when you're coming down the curve, you can move it around the country. There is a level of knowledge, professionalism, at times empathy that emanates from Albany that does not get repeated at some of these briefings in Washington. Although we'll say, you know, beyond the president, there are others who attend those briefings who, provide more useful and kind of, you know, actionable and sensible information. And then he comes in with color commentary.
There's so many different aspects to talk about of the way the story is playing out. One of them is this dynamic between the governors and the president, and the possibility that the president is playing favorites, making sure that some states, say Florida, gets everything that it wants, whereas other states that have not been sufficiently appreciative might not be getting as much. And also, Governor Cuomo talked about the way that states have been pitted against one another and against the federal government. I mean, you know, in Earth 2.0, this itself would be the scandal. This would be the Katrina level scandal, but it's subsumed under so much. Okay, you're the economics guy. Let's talk about this. There are some jobs numbers that are going to be coming out this week. They're going to be bad, but I think, as you've pointed out, they're only going to provide a preliminary shot. So give me your sense of what we're going to see on Friday, what the situation is with the jobs market.
Right. I would say the first thing you want to do is really focus on Thursday morning, which is the next release of initial jobless claims numbers. People will remember that last week we hit a smashing all-time record of 3.3 million new jobless claims, initial jobless claims. The record before that was close to 600,000 in 1982. So we blew that away. Now, the question is, this Thursday, do we go up again? The official estimates are that we don't, that we go from 3.3 to something like 2.5. But pretty much every analyst and economist and Wall Street expert I talked to who studied the state-by-state data, the Google Trends searches for SEEK unemployment, thinks the number will be much higher, 4 million, 5 million, which would be a really scary number, that we're adding very, very rapidly to the ranks of the unemployed, you know, would be 7 million over the last 2 weeks, which is an insane number. And then, okay, Friday, we get the number that everybody generally pays attention to, which is the monthly jobs report, the employment report, which may not be super terribly awful. The estimate is a loss of 100,000, although now today I'm starting to read economist notes that are bumping that number up into, you know, multiple hundreds of thousands. But whatever the case, when they do this report, they survey, you know, early in the month. This survey will have been somewhere, you know, up to the 12th of March. And most of the lockdown, shutdown, shelter in place hadn't happened yet. A lot of the layoffs hadn't happened yet. So it may not be the worst one we get. It won't be the worst one we get. The April numbers, which we won't get until May, unfortunately, is probably going to be the one that looks cataclysmic, where we lose 5 to 10 million jobs and everybody freaks out and panics. So look at unemployment claims Thursday. That's probably a bigger number this week. And then Friday, it's either going to be bad or it's going to be really, really bad.
So the April numbers, where you're talking about millions of jobs lost. So you did a piece the other day, which I'm looking at right now, the different scenarios. By the way, for people who think that sometimes we're a little bit pessimistic on this podcast, I'm sorry, this won't be an example. It won't be an exception to it. You had three different scenarios: the bad, the very bad, and the apocalyptically worst. Okay, so this is the economy. So give me your idea of the bad, which is the best of the awful scenarios, just bad.
Bad. I mean, we're already in bad. That scenario looks like, you know, we hit the flattening of the curve of new infections, you know, nationwide sometime, you know, late April, early May. We have more widespread testing in place. Perhaps some of these other therapies that are under consideration prove effective. Obviously, we won't have a vaccine by then, but under that scenario, we can start to reopen parts of the economy, you know, by June, and people get back to work and start spending money again. And then critically under that scenario, everything that the government has done so far in terms of enhanced unemployment benefits, in terms of loans and grants to small and mid-sized businesses and efforts to rescue some of the bigger industries like airlines, all of those things work well. So we don't have the massive spike in unemployment that we might get. And that when these parts of the economy reopen, people actually have money in their pockets to spend and at least to the greatest extent possible, still have jobs. So under that scenario, you get you know, a second quarter where we lose, you know, 10% of economic growth, and then we start to rebound in the third and fourth quarter. So we don't go into a prolonged recession. We have a recession because we have two quarters of negative growth, but it ends quickly and we start to come back. There's pain in that scenario, but it's not awful.
Yeah, it's V-shaped then, and you have a very, very robust recovery near the end of the year.
Precisely. Yeah. Yep. If it's not V, it's at least a gentle U.
Okay. So that's the bad. What's the very bad?
Well, the very bad is, you know, we don't get it under control, you know, by late April, early summer. We have to extend lockdowns for folks. You know, we get larger and larger jobless claims and unemployment numbers. The rollout of the federal programs is clunky and doesn't save enough employers and requires another round. You see state budgets start to kind of crater under the pressure of lost revenues. And then you get, you know, multiple quarters of significantly negative growth. We can't get back to work until the fall. And you have a, you know, sharp, prolonged recession in which unemployment, you know, gets into the double digits and maybe the mid double digits. That's the very bad scenario.
And we're going to get some consumer confidence numbers coming out.
Yeah, we had consumer confidence. We had that yesterday. Yeah, it dropped. It didn't drop as large as some people feared. I mean, it definitely, you know, plunged like 20 points or something, but it's still in decent territory. But again, this is a survey that captured probably a lot before things got really bad. So we might have to wait for the next one to see it really drop, because consumer confidence is definitely going down. You see it in other less focused on surveys where it's the bottom is kind of falling out of it. So this is, again, delayed numbers that I wouldn't put a lot of faith in.
Okay, so the very bad scenario, economic growth drops even more sharply, second quarter stays down for the rest of the year, but that's not the worst. Okay, so we've had bad, the very bad. What's the worst? The doomsday scenario.
Yeah, well, the doomsday scenario, I hate to even talk about it. I feel like I'm, you know, in Dr. Strangelove talking about the doomsday machine. But that is the scenario under which the 1 to 2 million people plus in the United States die, where we do not get control of the growth of the virus and we get multiple recurrences of it after we think we've bent the curve. And then we have to go into nationwide lockdown for a considerable period of time, which means almost total and complete economic halt. That means recession turns to depression, which, you know, has no formal definition, but just means, you know, quarter after quarter of negative growth. Stock market collapses, way further than it has so far. And that's the scenario where I fear, you know, significant social unrest, where people are running out of food and water and supplies, and they're panicking. And then you get, you know, people in the streets and looting, and the need for the National Guard or even more interventions to try to restore social order. That's the doomsday scenario.
So that would be, 25% unemployment.
That would be more like 30 plus.
30 plus. So what is the very bad, the very bad projection on unemployment?
Some of the, very bad ones are 10 to 15.
Oof, these are just stunning numbers.
Yeah. So bad would be more like, we just go up to 5 or 6.
Okay. Let's talk about the odds of the various scenarios. The scenario that you just gave, the apocalyptic doomsday scenario, you suggest that the odds of that taking place is around 10%, 1 out of 10 chance, way higher than I'd like it to be.
Yeah. I might, if given the chance to do it again, I might put it closer to 5, partly to not freak people out and partly because, I do think it's unlikely that we reach that given, we are now pretty much doing what we should be doing in terms of, all of the social distancing stuff. And, I am hopeful about some of the treatments and the tests coming from Abbott and, the way the curve is looking in certain places, Italy for one, I get a little more hopeful when I look at some of that stuff. And we got scared with that 100,000 number, which is terrible. But if it somehow sticks to that, then we don't go doomsday. So I might dial that down a little bit.
Okay, so bad and very bad. What would your updated percentages be?
I think we're still probably looking at very bad. I mean, I think I put that somewhere in the 60s.
Odds of that scenario, 65%.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that's still more likely than not that we don't quite escape with a just bad, and there are shades in between these gradations. So it could be somewhere between bad and very bad. I just think the idea that we're really, approaching the point where we can significantly reopen the economy is just not there. And that we've missed the chance to avoid the very bad by not moving more quickly on federal aid. And it's going to take a while to get to people. So we're just going to have a lot more job losses than we want, and a lot more people coming out of this with really no income and no money in their pocket to spend, although, they'll get some government checks. So we can't just simply pop back blockbuster 20% growth, 30% growth in the third quarter. I mean, maybe, Goldman Sachs thinks we can. I'm not sure if I agree with them. But I think we're somewhere between bad and very bad at this point.
See, this is the problem, isn't it? That we're experiencing something that there's no precedent for. We don't know what happens when you suffocate the economy for a certain amount of time. Does it just simply take a deep breath and jump back up and, try to get back on its feet? Or if you, hold a pillow over its face long enough, you just kill it. We just don't know. I mean, I've been in discussions where people argue the same thing. Well, why not? I mean, there's nothing systemically wrong. We're just taking a break and there'll be all this pent up demand. So, yes, it will be bad for a while and then everybody will, it will come roaring back. But we just don't know all of the structural changes, all of the changes. I mean, you get this, it is so huge that you know that there are going to be social, cultural changes, political changes, changes in people's attitudes, and that are incredibly unpredictable under the circumstances. I mean, you know, for example, just take what we sort of started off here. If this goes through the end of May, what is the psychological toll on Americans? And does that have any economic consequence long term?
I think it absolutely does. I mean, it's certainly had a psychological impact on me so far. I think it's had a psychological impact on everyone. And then, you know, the snap back, bounce back question assumes that, you know, everybody rushes back out and resumes life as normal, which isn't going to happen because people are still going to be frightened. You know, does everybody jam into the restaurants and bars as soon as the green light is on? I don't think so. I'd be shocked to see that. It's going to take a while for people to reacclimate. And when they do reacclimate, it'll be in different ways. And again, you know, the fundamental idea behind this snapback is that, you know, everybody's flush with cash and jobs, and that's not going to be the case. You know, I did an interview for my column today with Jan Hatzius, who's the chief economist at Goldman Sachs, and he's a believer in the snapback theory. And I pressed him a little bit and I said, you know, how do you know this? Like, how can you model what's going to happen, A, with the virus, and B, with how people react? And he basically said, you know, admitted that he couldn't, that economists generally are flying blind here. They're trying to use empirical data as much as they can. But as you said, we've just never experienced this, you know, in the modern economy. And nobody, frankly, knows how it's going to look when we come back.
Yeah, there's always that psychological hangover after every one of these downturns. And this psychological hangover, I think, is going to be, you know, long lasting, just in terms of, you know, how we feel about resources, how we interact with one another. I also think it's going to be interesting to know how businesses make the decision to bring everybody back or to open up, because who wants to be the first ones?
Right.
I mean, there's going to be, you know, I mean, obviously medical advice is crucial, but there's also going to be a certain social pressure. And I think there might be a reluctance on the part of some folks to be in that first group to say, hey, you know, the water's fine, come back in.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it'll be phased in as well. For a lot of companies that have done layoffs, you know, they're not necessarily bringing those people back at all, but there are a lot who have done furloughs, which is, you know, basically letting people keep their benefits, but not paying them during a period where there's, you know, no revenue coming in. And I don't think all those people are coming back. They're certainly not coming back right away, you know, partly because of, you know, business is not being sure how fast revenue is going to pick up. But then there's also going to be this lingering fear of, you know, is there a second wave in the fall? Is there a third wave? Have we really crossed this thing? And then do you bring everybody back only to lay them off or furlough them again? So that's why I think it'll be a slower process. And as you say, there'll be a lot of tentativeness on the part of, you know, both big and small companies to immediately bring all their staff back.
You just made a very important point here, because I was looking at a chart of the way the Spanish flu played out back in 1918, and it came in three waves.
Right.
And this is the real, I mean, in terms of some of the really scary scenarios, is that we've made these immense sacrifices, had these immense dislocations, and then, you know, crawl out of our basements, you know, into the light again, you know, looking for, you know, a good way to get back to normal. And then it hits again. Right. And you have the impact on human life, but also just the psychological impact and the economic impact of having to go through it again. And that, I think, is completely incalculable at this point. And that this might all be occurring in the context of a presidential election campaign. I mean, imagine this stuff starts coming back in October, and all the implications for politics and for the election is...
It's kind of hard to contemplate. It's going to be like nothing we've ever seen. And the only thing I can hope for on that front is that we've, you know, made enough medical advances and are close enough to vaccine or whatever by that point that it's not as bad when it comes back, or more people have immunity and that sort of thing. And the serology that is there.
Well, that's the, you know, you hope that all those things happen. And as you mentioned in your article, though, we still don't know how widespread it's going to be in other cities. I mean, right now we're all talking about New York, and yeah. I think Governor Cuomo last week said, hey, you know, this is not about New York. This is what's going to be happening in other cities when it starts happening in right. In the heartland. The other question, of course, is what's happening to the global economy right now, because yeah. you certainly have the possibility of global travel and global trade being almost completely shut down. And yeah. we could get back on our feet. But in terms of the snapback theory, what happens if the rest of the world goes into lockdown? I mean, we are not going to be unaffected by what happens in India or in Europe, China, obviously.
No, certainly not. And hopefully, you know, China is coming out on the other side of this, God willing, and you know, we can continue to trade with them. Obviously, you know, we have the tariff issues that are a separate issue, but, you know, there are tons of American companies that have been completely, you know, basically unable to do business because they source their products from China and can't get them. My wife's company happens to be one of them. You know, it's just, you can't put them on planes. Maybe you put stuff on boats, but then it comes here and there's no way to sell it. But, you know, the United States is absolutely not immune from the global economy. We still are a mainly consumer oriented, domestic driven economy. So, you know, we can do okay when the rest of the world is sick, but we can't do great by any means. And if, you know, Europe is in sharp recession, and if, you know, the UK is hurting, and if India in particular is problematic, given that so many US companies outsource back office functions to India, as we all know, you know, call centers, we've all had experience with that. But it's not just that. There's, you know, there's payroll, there's, you know, all sorts of other back office operations that U.S. companies outsource to India and would be unable to do under that sort of scenario, and would somehow have to reshore all of it, which, you know, might thrill some people in the White House, but it's not easy to do and it's costly. So yes, if, you know, the United States somehow comes back, but the rest of the world is suffering, you know, we can still have an economy under that scenario, but we would have a hamstrung and damaged economy.
So what happens next? A lot of talk now about a possible infrastructure plan. Nancy Pelosi talking about that. The president tweeting out about a big infrastructure plan. What are the prospects there?
I'm dubious. I'm generally dubious every time we bring up infrastructure as a possibility. Obviously, you know, badly needed, and we should be doing it. You know, the president touting it is, you know, a positive. But they always wind up in totally different places, Republicans and Democrats, on how you structure it, how you fund it, whether it's just a huge infusion of federal cash or it's in conjunction with the private sector, and the private sector puts up a lot of the money with government backstops. There's so many differences between the parties on that front. And I also have to think, Charlie, and you'd know this better than I, among the Republican crowd, that just the idea of coming right back and doing another $2 trillion that would probably be unfunded and just adding to the debt and deficit. I know Republicans don't care as much about that as they have in the past, but it may be a tough pill for some of them to swallow. So I don't think it's impossible, particularly if things get worse and the government has to come back. And it'd be great, you know, to use this opportunity to maybe improve our crummy infrastructure. But then you got to think about city and state budgets too, which are on the cusp of, you know, complete collapse as their revenues fall. So the federal government's going to have to intervene there and help prop up some of these state governments, state budgets, so they don't have to lay off all their workers. So there's a lot of needs and a lot of places money needs to go. Infrastructure is one, but I'm just not bullish on the idea that, you know, there can be a kumbaya moment between, you know, Pelosi and McConnell and Schumer on how we do infrastructure. You know, maybe these are crazy times, crazy things happen, but I'm not in the camp that thinks, yeah, we're definitely doing this.
Yeah, well, it's one thing we haven't had. We haven't had an infrastructure week in a while. I just wanted to sort of mention one thing before we're done here. The, you know, I live in Wisconsin, obviously, in less than a week, we have an election. We are the only state in the country that had scheduled an election that has not postponed it. Mm. And this, despite the fact that there are hundreds of municipalities that cannot find enough poll workers to open even a single polling place. So I just saw recently that in the city of Milwaukee, they're going to have only 12 polling places in the entire city of Milwaukee for voting, which is just is sort of stunning. And kind of a warning about what could happen in November, because, I mean, I don't think it takes a huge amount of imagination to realize that thousands, if not tens of thousands of voters are going to be effectively disenfranchised. If you are, for example, if you're in isolation and you're, living by yourself and we're under a lockdown order, you can't even really effectively vote by absentee ballot because you can't have anyone sign. You might not have a witness to sign your ballot. But this is going to be one of those issues that I think is going to be percolating out there. And, you know, in a future podcast, we'll discuss why Republicans in Wisconsin are so anxious to go ahead with this election, and have been opposed to any of the proposals to make absentee mail-in voting easier. So
this drives me nuts. I look forward to listening to that podcast because the fact that our election systems are so antiquated and ridiculous and people resist, all mail ballot, absentee ballot, or moving towards electronic voting. I mean, come on, man. This is 2020 in the United States of America. We should be well beyond this nonsense.
Exactly. Ben White, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. We appreciate it very, very much.
Always a pleasure, Charlie. Thank you.
And again, happy birthday.
So, yeah, I appreciate that. 25 again.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.